This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a fellow immigrant comes to the defense of Ilhan Omar, the Black congresswoman who stood up to both the Zionist lobby and former Death Squad organizer Elliot Abrams. And we'll discuss the restorative justice doctrine of the prison abolition movement.
But first, the United States has declared economic war on the socialist government of Venezuela and seems on the verge of military action. The Trump administration blatantly seized billions of dollars in Venezuelan assets and has declared its intention to replace Venezuela's government with a president of Washington's own choosing. We spoke with Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace.
Not only did they steal the assets of the sovereign state, but in your question, you referenced something that's also very important. One of the important differences of the coup that's unfolding in Venezuela from coups in the past. In the past, much of the activity to destabilize and to effect regime change used to be done in the shadows. But today, because of the shift in political realities and the kind of conditioning, I believe, that has taken place has resulted in the public supporting these kinds of blatant illegal moves against various states, has resulted in the CIA and the intelligence agencies and the State Department not having to hide their attempts to destabilize a sovereign nation. So that is one of the most important differences, and it really is a reflection of the hegemony of rightist politics in the U.S. And it's also, I think, helps to explain the bipartisan support that this move being made by the Trump administration on Venezuela is receiving from both parties.
Yes, it seems that imperialism is the ideology not just of both political parties, but of almost all the public speakers in the United States.
Exactly, including those elements that proclaim themselves to be part of the so-called left. This notion that there's some kind of benevolent hegemon that will intervene on the side of the people that's concerned with the humanity of people outside of the U.S. borders is obscene. But yet this position is a position that even people on the left seem to have embraced, not only in Venezuela, but in other situations like in Syria. So it's a very dangerous, troubling ideological context that we have to operate in today when it comes to trying to mobilize opposition to intervention into Venezuela. We have the Sanders folks that, you know, Sanders referred to Chavez as a dead dictator. We have people on the left that even when they claim to be opposed to intervention, still believe they have some obligatory requirement to talk about Maduro being some kind of dictator and the process in Venezuela being the result of their own internal incompetence. So this is the political environment that we have in the U.S. and in Western Europe, but providing political cover and illegitimate legitimacy to this intervention into Venezuela.
Yes, and of course, we hear nothing from the Congressional Black Caucus, and that is par for the course. But one gets the impression that, by and large, most Black folks don't understand the stark racial nature of divisions in Venezuela, as in most of Latin America.
Well, that's another one of the differences, that there used to be almost instinctual understanding among African people in the U.S., that when the U.S. was engaged in interventions and wars against people outside of its borders, they understood that there was a racial element in most of those cases. And therefore, there was great skepticism, if not outright resistance. But that kind of skeptical consciousness has almost evaporated, that the confusion is more an ideological shift than just confusion. I think there are some people who understand that the unfair nature of this intervention is even criminal character, but who are in ideological alignment with U.S. imperialism, especially when, as you said in your question, their black leaders, if you will, seem to be either silent or in support of this intervention. So there's confusion, but also there's the reflection of a serious ideological shift to the right, which again characterizes the objective environment that those of us who are on the anti-war left, the anti-imperialist left, have to contend with. We have to come to terms with those objective and subjective realities in order to fashion strategies that can result in us making some degree of progress in trying to reverse that kind of consciousness.
And the reality in Venezuela, as reporter Greg Pallas pointed out in an important article, is that most of the darker folks in Venezuela are allied with the socialist government. And the white elite, which is allowed, has been allowed to operate profitably and openly for the past 20 years, that white elite is firmly on the side of regime change.
Exactly. That racial element is really quite stark. People have to understand that the so-called revolution in Latin America, the revolt against Spanish colonial rule, was, like the so-called revolution in the U.S., an incomplete revolution in the sense that it did not shift power from the hands of the white Creole class in Latin America, like it didn't shift power from the white in North America to any other sector of the population. So there is an unfinished revolution in that sense. So the white Creole class ended up the hegemonic force in most of the nations throughout Latin America. They make up the oligarchy, if you will. And so it's been the oligarchy that's been revolt against the Bolivarian process. And it's been the people of color, in particular African people, who have been at the core of the support of the Bolivarian process. And that's why during the uprisings of the right over the last year and a half, 2 years, uprisings have been quite violent. We saw over and over again cases where there were racialized attacks on people of color by the radical right because of the assumption that if you were mixed skin or dark skin or clearly African, you were probably a supporter of the government. And there were a number of people who were lynched, burnt alive during that period. So this is the nature of the opposition, the racialized opposition, and the racial component of this is even more graphically reflected in the lineup of those states that are in support of Juan Guaido's declaration that he is, in fact, the president. You have most of the European Union lining up in support. You have many of the people of color nations who are in opposition. So this racial component is a component that has to be brought into the conversation, has to be brought into the context of understanding in order for us to really understand how we need to approach this issue in Venezuela and other issues like this are going to emerge. Because, look, this notion of a humanitarian intervention, the responsibility to protect, this is nothing but 21st century version of the white man's burden. And the fact that this resonates with people in the U.S. and in Europe is a very serious political and ideological problem.
Yes, the more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. In Venezuela, this white elite and its racism is quite blatant. These are people who never underwent a civil rights movement or were disciplined by anything like a black power movement. These are people who would put on the front pages of their newspaper pictures, cartoons of President Hugo Chavez, depicting him as a monkey, and they had no shame in doing that.
Exactly. And many people have suggested, if you really look at the population of Venezuela, an argument can be made that over 50% of that population really consists of people of African descent. Now, we know that the racial complexities of many of these nations in Latin America are such where people who would be classified as African in North America don't necessarily embrace that identity in these various countries. But it's basically a country that is made up primarily of mixed race and African people being controlled, economically controlled by this same white oligarchy. So yeah, that racial component is really important. But going back to the U.S. in terms of the racial component, one asks the question, what gives the Trump administration legitimacy in being able to argue that it has a right, along with the European Union, to determine the leadership of that nation? And I would argue, and I argued in my piece, that this is the assumptions, that the arrogance of the white supremacist consciousness, the white privilege that says that basically they have the right to arrest and to bomb and invade and sanction and murder and violate international law any place on the planet to advance their interests. And the fact that this is being accepted in the U.S. and the racial element of this arrogant position is not even recognized, to me, again, is another example of the normalization of white supremacist ideology in the U.S. and really throughout the Western world. And it's something that we have to contend with, because that white supremacist ideology does not have any respect for race. One can be an African and still be a white supremacist. So white supremacist ideology is pervasive now as a hegemonic framework and lens among African people.
And with all of the news coverage, and I use that word advisedly, of Venezuela, one hears not a word about international law.
Exactly. I mean, what gives the U.S. the legal right to intervene? The U.S. state under both George Bush and then Barack Obama and now under Trump stretched this authorization to use military force that came out of the 9/11 period to engage in lawless interventions and warmongering across the planet. But even stretching that as far as you can, you can't use that in Venezuela. There's been no decision by the United Nations Security Council to authorize U.S. military intervention into Venezuela. So basically what we have here is a quintessential rogue state action. The definition of a rogue state, Glenn, is a nation or state that's regarded as breaking international law and posing a threat to the security of other nations. Now, if that doesn't capture what we've seen by the U.S. in the last few decades, which has been longer than that, but even more graphically in the last few decades, then I don't know what else does. The U.S. is a rogue state and a threat now, not only to international order, but a threat to the collective humanity. And the fact that we have significant numbers of people in this country that are in support of this rogue behavior represents a real threat, not only to people in the U.S., but a real threat to the people across the planet.
Many date this rogue behavior in the Western Hemisphere to the Monroe Doctrine of the 1820s, which this administration and previous ones seem to think is still in a force and has some force of law.
That Monroe Doctrine is really being evoked because of the declining economic and political power of the U.S. and what they see as the encroachment by powers in their backyard, Latin America, by powers like the Russians and the Chinese. And so the result for U.S. imperialism is to resort back to its bread and butter, which is the use of military force to destabilize a nation, put in place a puppet regime that will help to starve off the penetrations by the Russians and the Chinese. It is a situation that is very dangerous because of the fact that Venezuela is not only just a conflict between the U.S. and Venezuelan state, but because you have all these other factors involved now. And, you know, it's something that we have to really look at very closely. I mean, because the only way that they're going to be able to advance the military option in Venezuela is to include the participation of states in the region, primarily Colombia and Brazil. And we know we have a right-wing government in both places. In Colombia, we know that the U.S. has access to at least 7, if not 8, military bases. We know that there are unknown number of troops in the country, at least 1,000, if not more. So the infrastructure, the forward basing of troops and equipment is already in place if there's going to be an attempt to push their way into the country on February 23rd, the deadline that this fake government said they were going to bring in humanitarian assistance.
And we must point out that Colombia is now an associate member of NATO. And the doctrine of NATO is an attack against one is an attack against all member countries of NATO. So the United States could quite easily fabricate an attack by Venezuela on its neighbor Colombia to invoke a rationale for military intervention.
As a NATO global partner, that section may not apply. But what we're probably going to see more so than an attack by Venezuela on Colombia is the reverse. That is an attempt using this notion of humanitarian intervention, humanitarian aid on the part of Colombian forces to try to escort that military aid across the border and into Venezuela, which is, in fact, penetrating the sovereign territory of Venezuela, which will require Venezuela military forces to protect their territory. And the Minister of Foreign Affairs today from Venezuela was quite explicit in saying that Venezuela was going to protect every inch of his territory. So that is probably the more likely scenario on February 23rd. It's important that the listeners know that on that same day, we are organizing a global day of action in support of the people of Venezuela. So we're asking people to go to the streets to demonstrate their support for the sovereignty and the collective human rights of the people of Venezuela, their right to be free and to be self-determinant, and to oppose the arrogant imposition of white power by the Trump administration with the full support of their Democrat lackeys into a sovereign state in Latin America.
That was Jamil Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace.
The U.S. government, both corporate political parties, and the corporate media routinely lie about Venezuela, claiming the socialist government is a dictatorship. Ron Kovalik is a lawyer and author who served as an official observer of Venezuela's elections process.
So I've probably observed 6 elections, both elections in which the current president, Nicolas Maduro, ran. And they're very impressive elections. Jimmy Carter called Venezuela's electoral process the very best in the world. And it is amazing. I mean, they have this very elegant electoral system where you have to use your fingerprint even to turn on the voting machine, and you have to show a voter ID as well. And then you go and you vote electronically, and once you're done doing that, the voting machine prints out a paper receipt of how you voted, and you check to make sure that matches what you did on the electronic machine, and then you put that into a box. And by the end of the night, by the end of election night, it's something like at least one table in 55% of the voting places are audited to make sure that those paper receipts match up with the electronic count. And so, as you can tell, it's almost a foolproof process. And that's why really when people talk about sham elections in Venezuela, they never give any detail because there's no real good claim that they were a sham. But in any case, it's actually a system that we could learn a lot from, and yet it is so vilified.
Which is really curious. We understand that some politicians in the United States will just make things up out of whole cloth, but the New York Times and the Washington Post and Reuters and the whole of the corporate media have correspondents and stringers in Venezuela who are familiar with the actual elections.
Yeah, well, that is the incredible part, you know, and whenever you hear a report in the mainstream media on Venezuela, for example, on NPR, they will always interview one or two people, and that's all. And there will always be someone from the opposition. And by the way, always someone who speaks English, which really narrows the field of people they can talk to in Venezuela. You never hear the other side of the story. You know, so cutting to the chase, last May, about 6 million people voted for Nicolas Maduro as president. And yet, you never hear even one of those 6 million people on NPR or in the mainstream press. And so, yes, while they have journalists down there, so-called journalists down there, apparently, on the ground, they portray a very slanted story of what's happening in Venezuela. It's very discouraging.
Now, that was a contested election, and Maduro, as you said, won by a wide margin. But Guaido's party, the party of Juan Guaido, who's proclaimed himself to be president, boycotted the election. And his party has been arguing for regime change for some time now.
Yes, it's true that there was a portion of the opposition that boycotted that election and called for abstention from the voting. But meanwhile, as you know, there was an opposition candidate named Henry Falcone. He's from the business community of Venezuela. He represented a real difference between himself and Maduro. And interestingly, by the way, we know from Mark Weisbrot that the Trump administration put pressure on Falcone not to run in the election, threatened him with sanctions if he went forward with his candidacy. And that was because they were more interested in delegitimizing the election and the results of the election than they were actually getting a pro-U.S. person in office, which really says a lot about the U.S.'s contempt for democracy in Venezuela. So meanwhile, what happens is Falcone goes forward anyway, and there was large abstention. 46% of the electorate voted. So just under 50%, which is nothing to write home about, certainly. But again, compares to the U.S. fairly favorably. And of the 46% of the people who voted, again, 67% voted for Maduro. That is a free and fair election. And people did freely choose, some of them, not to vote at all, as many in the U.S. also choose to do. So again, to question the results of that election is just simply not fair. And again, the opposition, with the help of the U.S., did everything they could, or sectors of the opposition, to delegitimize that election. And it's that voice that you hear constantly in the mainstream press.
And more recently, polls undertaken by local Venezuelan pollsters not associated with the government show that more than 80% of Venezuelans oppose the sanctions by the United States, and a similar number are opposed to regime change.
Yes, which is quite an amazing figure. You know, in any country, to get 80% of the people to agree on anything is pretty incredible. And again, that shows where the Venezuelan people are at. And if we really cared about the will of the Venezuelan people, we would relent from regime change and we would relent from the sanctions. And yet we're claiming in the name of democracy to go forward with both of those things. So there is an incredible irony and hypocrisy, really, to all of that.
And the opposition in Venezuela is not unified. It's a very fractious bunch, as you mentioned. Some decided to participate in the election, some did not. But when Juan Guaido proclaimed himself president, significant portions of the opposition immediately protested.
Yes, well, of course, because, as you say, it's a divided opposition, like most oppositions, again, in other countries. They don't have a unified philosophy. And in fact, the only thing that has ever unified them is to get rid of Chavez and then Maduro. But yes, I mean, there's many in the opposition who don't want this self-appointed president to be the guy, because he has now kind of come out of nowhere. He never even ran for president, much less did he ever win an election for president. So even people on the opposition are not excited about that fact.
And you point out in an article that you wrote that although Venezuelans are suffering because of the sanctions and other economic problems, the poor of Venezuela are far better off now than before Hugo Chavez and his socialist government came to power.
Yes, that's exactly right. And when you see the demonstrations of the opposition versus the demonstrations in support of the government, there's a clear class and really racial difference there. You know, it tends to be the poor, darker-skinned Venezuelans who support Maduro and the government, and it tends to be the wealthier, whiter Venezuelans that support the opposition. And that's because the Chavez revolution, which Maduro continued, is focused on policies to lower the poverty rate, to increase economic equality, to build homes for the poor. In fact, the building of subsidized homes has continued well under the Maduro administration. They've built about 2.5 million subsidized homes for the poor. And people there remember this and are quite aware of this. And they know if the opposition comes to power, especially through a coup maneuvered by the United States, they know that they will be on the losing end of such a coup. And frankly, that many of them will be hunted to unroot the Bolivarian revolution, which has now been in place for 20 years, is not going to be a bloodless coup. It'll be very violent. And I think people need to realize that.
And 1.2 million people in Venezuela are under arms in a militia, a pro-government militia.
Yes, I mean, I think the Venezuelan people are very ready for any type of military-type intervention. They also have a lot of sophisticated weaponry, the military that they've gotten from Russia. This would not be a cakewalk if there were to be a military intervention. Again, even people who may not support Maduro would defend their country's sovereignty. And I think people need to understand that, just as people in this country would. If you can imagine if another country invaded the U.S. to get rid of Trump, even those who oppose Trump would defend our sovereignty against that type of intervention. And the Venezuelans are no different from us in that way, and they will fight. Again, I think the last thing we need is another war, and certainly a war in Latin America, which is not a place where you see war very often between states. So, yes, I think it would be a terrible conflict.
That was Dan Kovalik, author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Vladimir Putin. Kovalik was speaking from New York City.
Ilhan Omar, the new black congresswoman from Minnesota, was last week chastised by the top Democrat in Congress, Nancy Pelosi, for saying that congressional support for Israel is all about the Benjamins, baby, meaning it's all about the huge amount of money that Zionists wield in the U.S. political process. Congresswoman Omar, who was born in Somalia, also confronted President Trump's hitman on Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, who 40 years ago managed death squads in Latin America for the Reagan administration and was convicted of lying to Congress. We spoke with Shahid Buttar, a lawyer and former head of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Buttar was born in Pakistan. Last primary season, he ran against Nancy Pelosi for Congress. Buttar says Congresswoman Omar is a brave and righteous woman.
I find it a remarkable spectacle when it takes immigrants in office to defend fundamental American values at a time when our bipartisan establishment is so willing to sully them. I would describe her at the moment as a national hero. We've been waiting for decades, quite frankly, for someone to have that line of questioning with a U.S. national security official. And if you think about the serial military interventions that the U.S. has committed across the global south, particularly in Latin America, to plunder foreign countries and open them to resource extraction, the consequences for human rights be damned. I think that that's a blow to U.S. national security, certainly to our legitimacy and standing in the international community. And I think she was not only in the right to draw attention to those issues, but I think she exposed the illegitimacy of the U.S. And quite frankly, you know, she started out her line of questioning addressing whether or not Abrams could be trusted. And of course, the answer is no. He's had to apologize for lying to Congress before. And so why anyone would, quite frankly, take a contrary view astounds me.
But of course, the freshman congresswoman was pilloried from every quarter. She was not defended by Democratic leadership in Congress. Will that have a chilling effect on you should you win a seat in Congress?
Not me. I mean, in my mind, it just emboldens me to speak truth without power all the more. I mean, I think the fact that the Democratic establishment rallied against her reflects the need for us to replace the Democratic establishment. You can't claim to resist a corrupt criminal administration when marching in lockstep with it. And I see centrist Democrats doing that all day long on any number of issues that elude the public view because they're not objects of contention. And ultimately, I think the role of members of Congress is supposed to be precisely asking the hard questions that administration officials otherwise aren't forced to answer. And these are exactly the opportunity to ask those questions, to be perfectly honest, is exactly why I'm running, because nobody else is. And the last time I asked a question of a U.S. national security official, I got dragged out of the room in handcuffs. And they don't do that to members of Congress. And there are a lot of questions that these people have never been asked, have never had to answer.
Well, tell us about the circumstances of your arrest.
So this would have been spring of 2015, if I'm not mistaken. I was in D.C. at the time, leading an organization that had been founded in the early 2000s to fight the Patriot Act. And I went to a Senate Armed Services hearing chaired by then-Senator John McCain. The witness at the hearing was former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. About 6 months before this hearing, Eric Garner had died in New York City when NYPD agents had killed him extrajudicially without a charge or trial. And this was about 2 years after James Clapper had lied to the Senate under oath when asked a direct question, which he got in writing beforehand from Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon. And I basically asked Clapper, the Obama administration's senior national security, national intelligence director, how he justified never facing a charge for lying to the Senate under oath on the public record about a matter of global controversy and grave constitutional importance when Eric Garner, on the mere suspicion of committing a trivial offense, was killed in the street without any judicial process at all. And I think the contrast between impunity for the powerful, even for major crimes against the republic, and vicious predatory consequences for powerless people, even when our supposed crimes are trivial or when there are no crimes, right? I mean, Tamir Rice comes to mind here. Vast distinction to me exposes that our legal system is certainly separate and it's not even equal. And we live in an era when we pride ourselves on having supposedly civil rights that I think are illusory when you zoom in and look at the facts.
When you speak of replacing the leadership of the Democratic Party, you mean that literally Nancy Pelosi, the most powerful Democrat, the Speaker of the House, she's the politician that you ran against last time around and will run against again in the next primary.
That's exactly right. You know, the Speaker of the House has a vaunted reputation for being the face of the resistance to the administration of a corrupt criminal kleptocrat. And for what her tactical resistance is worth, I am grateful. That tactical resistance, however, I would describe as having only limited worth if we want to have goals that actually contrast with the president. At the end of the day, the Democrats capitulated to the president with respect to his border wall, you know, giving over $1 billion for corrupt enterprise that they shouldn't have given a cent for. Remember, this is a country that claims we don't have our money to pay teachers. Yet somehow the Democrats found $1.5 billion to throw at Donald Trump to build his needless boondoggle on the southern border. Moreover, I go particularly to when the new congressional session started, one of the very first things that Speaker Pelosi did was adopt a set of rules that were the principal target goal of Republicans in the 90s. That is the PAYGO rules that require Congress to offset any new spending with corresponding tax increases or reductions in spending for other programs. And that sort of, I'm using air quotes here, fiscal responsibility rule was the object of a great deal of partisan contention in the 90s. Republicans were very insistent on it. Democrats, to their credit in one era, were resistant to it because, of course, our government is very happy to engage in deficit spending for weapons. And the PAYGO rules prevent us from doing deficit spending, for instance, for healthcare. And that unilateral adoption of a central Republican goal, I think, exposes that, you know, despite Nancy Pelosi's deserved reputation for being a master tactician, in entirely too many places, her goals align with the Trump administration's. I see that expressed all the more clearly in the supposed partisan consensus around U.S. support for the coup in Venezuela. You know, we were just talking about Representative Ilhan Omar and her insightful, brilliant, forceful, and long overdue questioning of Elliot Abrams. Why hasn't Nancy Pelosi asked questions like that? She represents the capital of the peace and justice movement in the United States. And unfortunately, her record is replete with instances of being co-opted by the national security establishment, even going back to the Bush administration. You know, she voted to fund Bush's wars. I've heard veterans describe that to me as refusing to let the troops come home. She turned a blind eye to torture and helped sweep it under the rug when she was read into the CIA's brutal international human rights violations when she was the Speaker of the House under the Bush administration.
Well, that basically goes for most of the Democrats. You've described yourself as having run on a platform very much like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and plan to do so again, but with a much more critical approach to U.S. foreign policy.
That's right. I see Representative Ocasio-Cortez, like Representative Ilhan Omar, as the brilliant, insightful, visionary trailblazer. And quite frankly, I am happy to follow her lead. I do think there are some areas where the incoming freshman might be, you know, if you look at Representative Omar's apology, at least with respect to Venezuela, it seems that they need some support ultimately. And I think that if nothing else, we need to remove the members of Congress who represent very deep blue cities who are willing to support right-wing and corporate rule. And at the end of the day, I see Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Omar and others, along with Bernie Sanders, as figures in government who are challenging corporate rule, who are putting the needs of people and communities before those of corporations. And I think that the opportunity to help stand alongside them is an inspiring one. And I think the need to replace centrists with people committed to people before profit is the central need facing our generation, particularly if you look at this distinction through the lens of the Green New Deal and the climate crisis. This last fall, the UN gave us essentially, we have 11 and a half years left to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions to prevent catastrophic future consequences. And it's worth noting here, you know, a lot of people describe this as saving the earth. We should be clear, the earth doesn't care what we do. The question is whether or not your grandkids will be around to enjoy it. And will they have a chance to survive and thrive, or will they instead be resigned to misery because we're too greedy in the present instance to challenge the fossil fuel extraction companies that are poisoning the air and future generations?
That was Shahid Buttar speaking from San Francisco.
President Trump surprised lots of people with his support of a recently passed prison reform bill. Trump loudly and proudly campaigned as a law and order candidate. Vincent Lloyd is a professor of theology and religious studies at Villanova University. Lloyd is author, along with Joshua Dubler, of a recent article on Restorative Justice, a philosophy to replace and abolish mass incarceration. We asked Lloyd how prison abolition is faring in the age of Trump.
That's a great question, and I think the answer is a bit surprising. Criminal justice reform has been on the agenda from the Obama administration into the present. There were hopes that a few years ago it would pass, but it was under, with the push by Jared Kushner and his allies, that a bad bill, but a bill nonetheless, moved forward in Congress and got signed by President Trump. It's a bad bill because it affects very few of those incarcerated, and it is a bad bill because it advances sort of technical solutions that are just incarceration by other means. But the passage of that bill does represent the growing consensus in mainstream American political culture that something is dramatically wrong with our prison system. And I think that's a good thing, right? It's a marker of support for changing and opening the conversation about, you know, what will come after the prison. The prison hasn't always been here, and it won't always be here in the future. And that's a conversation that we can now have because people from left to right, center, and every direction are seeing that something has to change with the American criminal justice system.
Well, essentially, critics of the American criminal justice system say that it puts people in prison for far too long, and it is targeted at putting certain kinds of people in prison, especially black people. But the concept of restorative justice goes beyond those kinds of numbers.
Right. And the concept of restorative justice is at its essence, when there's a harm in a community, we should be focused on healing that community, bringing together all of the individuals in that community to name that harm and come up with a plan for making that community whole again. But this sort of label of restorative justice and a package of practices that can go along with it is also easily co-opted and is being co-opted by the criminal justice system itself as an appendage to jails and prosecutors and municipal governments. So what we were trying to do in this article that you mentioned is to look back at the time when restorative justice was a new innovation in the 60s and 70s and see how restorative justice at that moment was linked with prison abolition. It was seen as an abolitionist, part of an abolitionist worldview, to say, we can see a world without prisons, and we are going to start making that world, enacting that world in the present, developing the practices that can make that world possible in the present. That linkage between prison abolition and restorative justice has been fading and severing in our neoliberal present, and I think it's time to restore that linkage.
With the advent of the Black Lives Matter movement and the issue of black community control of the police, the whole question is being turned over in the minds of many black activists about what policing should look like in the black community and what the criminal justice system should do for and with and in that community. So has the Black Lives Matter movement's advent opened up this whole conversation about crime and punishment?
Yes, so certainly there are a lot of factors that were converging to put criminal justice transformation, not just reform, at the center of the mainstream political conversation now. And racial justice activism is part of that from the right. Concerns about the cost of the criminal justice system and the cost of prisons, particularly post-2008-2009 financial crisis. Part of that shifting political culture, media, right? There are lots of factors that are changing the conversation. But I think one of the really great things about the Black Lives Matter associated activism around criminal justice issues is that it's really putting front and center the question of, you know, who should be deciding about these questions? Should it be bureaucrats? Should it be politicians? Or should authority be in the hands of the community? To whom should the police be accountable? To whom should prosecutors be accountable? And first and foremost, that should be the neighborhoods, communities that are supposedly being served. I think that's the way to sort of leverage this broad consensus that something needs to change into actually transformative action by, you know, shifting this sort of center of authority.
Yes, when you speak of an approach to crime that involves making whole communities whole, well, that makes the assumption that we have communities rather than antagonistic groups of people who want vengeance and harm against each other.
Yes, it does. And in the same way that abolitionism as a social movement over the last century or more than a century envisions a world without domination, right? Which, of course, is impossible in the sort of world that we have. Right? There will always be forms of oppression, always be forms of domination. But the abolitionist spirit is one that says, when we find domination, we have to say no. And that refusal can motivate our work both against domination and in building new social institutions. So I would think of community in a similar way, right? That it is true that community is always antagonistic and fragmented and so on, but as a place to turn, away from the wealthy and the powerful, it can motivate movements, that ideal of community, even as we're recognizing all along that it is complicated and requires constant interrogation for new forms of domination that are always being recognized in this ideal of community.
This restorative justice model has had some success in faraway New Zealand and Australia.
Yes, this is one of the sort of surprising aspects of the story of restorative justice, that there's a moment when innovators, particularly Christian, religiously motivated innovators in the United States, are trying out restorative justice models. There are also academic sociologists and criminologists in Scandinavia and in the U.S. who are trying to think differently about the prison system and to move from retributive model, an eye for an eye, to a restorative model. And it really does pick up traction and gain some national acceptance in New Zealand and Australia, where punitive model for juveniles is completely eliminated in New Zealand and replaced with a restorative model. And Australia takes strides in those directions as well, sometimes drawing on the indigenous communities that are in Australia and New Zealand and the sorts of practices that they've been using for generations and generations to deal with harms in their communities, even as you've rightly troubled that notion of community. Community can still be a site where wisdom of elders is preserved and made available for us to access against the forces of corporate and political domination.
Here in the United States, where would the wisdom of elders be tapped in the Black and Latino communities domestically?
Well, there's some great organizing projects, some behind bars and some in grassroots movements that are experimenting with what restoration looks like. Greaterford Prison here in the Philadelphia outskirts, a group of incarcerated men who've been reflecting on their own experiences, the experiences of those that they've known, and trying to develop practices for righting wrongs that are not just focused on a victim and a perpetrator, where the perpetrator is always demonized and the victim is always, elevated to a saintly status, but recognizing that we have all been harmed and victimized in our lives, particularly Black and brown folks in many systematic ways, over time for generations, starting from that shared experience of victimization and pain, trying to develop practices that acknowledge that, but also acknowledge real harm that has been done and the need to bring communities back together. So looking at that wisdom of elders who are incarcerated and who've been formerly incarcerated, that's where I would turn.
We have lots of elders in prison, and some of them are political prisoners who've been there for decades and decades. Aren't those sources of wisdom? But that's not the kind of political wisdom that this society wants to hear now, just like they didn't want to hear it back then.
Yes, certainly political prisoners are important to listen to and are too often forgotten in discussions about criminal justice reform or mass incarceration, when the prison population can be reduced to numbers, statistics, percentages, or on the other hand, reduced to, the bare humanity of our fellow man or woman that is being kept in a cage. Both of those perspectives, the statistical and the sort of humanistic, overlook the political structures and systems that make possible the prison system and that are represented by political prisoners who are incarcerated for speaking out against those systems of domination that need to be challenged.
You were speaking of the restorative justice strides that have been made in New Zealand, and that's very interesting because the Maori population in New Zealand, the dark folks, the people who were there before the whites came to New Zealand, comes to about 10% of the population, and their mass incarceration rate very much matches that of Black Americans. So they are suffering from extreme, severe mass Maori incarceration. Has restorative justice done anything to lessen that scourge?
Yeah, this is a great point that when we think about hyper-incarceration, mass incarceration that focuses on particular communities in the U.S., we think of poor Black folk in other countries, right? The same sorts of dynamics of racialization tied with economic exploitation, you know, are present, but, you know, targeted at different communities. So indigenous communities in Australia, New Zealand, and, you know, in France and Europe, Muslim communities that are racialized, you know, as brown folks. This is a problem all over with systems of incarceration that seem like they're neutral, they're facially neutral, but they ended up targeting the poorest and the racialized. But in terms of your question, the challenge with restorative justice is that the vision that it once had and represented of is too idealized, as you rightly point out, the sense of community restored, community broken, community as an ideal, right, that never really existed, right? It's the instinct behind that idealization, which abolitionist instinct behind that instinct, right, that there's a system that needs to be overturned, not fixed, but overturned, dramatically transformed, pulled up by the roots. That's the instinct that once animated restorative justice, and that instinct has fallen away as restorative justice has become an appendage of the state, whether it's in New Zealand or whether it's in Chicago or whether it's in Scandinavia. And one of the things that in this article Josh Huber and I are calling for is a return to that original abolitionist instinct, which there's a higher law that runs against the laws on the books, and that higher law calls us to oppose both the practices of the prosecutors and the courts, but also to envision a more just world, a world where folks can flourish in right relation to each other. So that's why restorative justice is important to me or to Josh and I, because it names that instinct, that abolitionist instinct, which we think is so important.
So you're speaking of restorative justice as, in fact, a revolutionary concept. And your article mentions Angela Davis, a prison abolition advocate. But of course, your concept of restorative justice is deeply religious. Angela Davis is deeply secular.
Yes, so we start this article by naming a judge in Indiana who was convinced by his religious convictions, by his belief in a higher law and belief in God's law, that he needed to take a man who he had sentenced to jail out of jail and allow that man to enroll in a restorative justice program that would mean working for the family who there had been goods stolen from, and by working for that family to make amends, to make right what had been harmed. And we're trying to point out that that was motivated by a religious commitment at that time, articulated as a belief and faith and commitment to God's law. This kind of commitment that there is justice beyond the criminal justice system certainly can be expressed in many different idioms, whether it's Marxist idiom or humanistic idiom or a Christian idiom or a Muslim idiom or an indigenous idiom. But that structure is the same, or the commitment to justice beyond the criminal justice system, which means when the criminal justice system veers so far off course, so far from that true concept of justice, that we need to abolish that problematic system, that criminal justice system, that prison system.
This presence of churches in the criminal justice system is, for many of us, quite disturbing and frightening. For example, many churches have after-prison programs, some of them financed by the government under the faith-based grants. And we see that people are being released from prison conditional on them getting involved in these church-based programs. It seems that prisoners are being coerced to get involved in the church in order to get out of prison.
Certainly, there are religious communities that exploit prisoners to advance their own agendas. There are religious communities that, you know, have their own ideological programs, often tied with the interests of the ruling class, and advance those programs by means of their involvement in the criminal justice system. And I mean, this is one of the concerns with this Trump-Kushner so-called reform bill, is that it provides more openings for religious groups, and by religious groups they have in mind conservative, evangelical, white religious groups. It provides more openings for them to enter into the criminal justice system. So certainly that's a big problem. But when we look at the language of prison abolition groups and the experiences and the formations of activists around prison abolition work, we find time and time again that many activists, even if most of the time they're expressing their abolitionism in a secular idiom, have been formed in some way by a Christian or Muslim religious community that allows them to see the ways of the road do not have the last word, right? That something radically different is possible. That formation is really important. There's also, as we see and circulating in social media around Black Lives Matter and associated movements and this millennial Black activism these days, which seems on the surface of it secular or, you know, rejecting churches or an old-fashioned kind of respectable Christianity. There's also a language of spirituality that circulates in those spaces, and hauntings and ancestors and futures and imaginings and things like mysticism, a really deeply spiritual sense that can't just be reduced away. So acknowledging that those spiritual cravings and intuitions that many activists on these issues have can be a starting point for connecting with letting Christian communities know that there's common ground here, that there are spiritual activists working for prison abolition, and maybe Christian communities who are, you know, happy with marginal reforms should be thinking more transformatively, more radically about prison abolition and the abolition of all systems of domination.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.